We're back on the road with our fifth live taping episode. And leaders, I know this episode is long, but we know you all love some 2020 action, so we got it all right here for you, right now. For this episode, we taped in front of a crowd of dedicated whipcrackhead leaders at Seminar Brewing in Florence last Thursday. And if you missed it, don't worry, just keep it locked on our social media and you'll be up to date on every time we have a new live taping. So without any further ado, here we are in Florence at Seminar Brewing. Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of April 2nd, 2019. Happy birthday, Caitlin Shire. We are in Florence with a rowdy Magic City crowd here at Seminar Brewing. Great to be in the PD, great to be in Florence. And we're back on the 2020 campaign trail with y'all, campaign trail. I know it's been about a month since our last dedicated 2020 show. You know, other things are happening in the state right now, but a lot is happening on the trail too in South Carolina. New candidates have jumped into the race, campaign staffs are ramping up, and the courtship of voters is staying strong here at the Palmetto Debutante Ball. We are 333 days away from our Leap Day primary, and we catch you up with some of the best campaign trail guides this side of the Mississippi. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who wrote the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections instead of explaining that Florence isn't just a left-hand turn off of 95 on the way to Myrtle Beach. Or instead of listening to your friends talk about the movie Us. Was it that great? It was that great.
Us changed everything.
We watched it last night. It was great.
It changed everything, guys.
Without further ado, it's time for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, the Post and Courier reports that the 1st Congressional District Representative Joe Cunningham introduced a bill to ban offshore drilling and seismic testing in both the Atlantic and Pacific regions. McClatchy, D.C. reported that House leadership selected Cunningham, who was in a historically Republican district, to lead the offshore fight, which was a central issue to his campaign. His predecessor, Mark Sanford, introduced similar legislation in 2017. Number two, the Associated Press reports that the South Carolina House has given key approval to a bill to create a searchable database of property seized by police. The bill also states that a criminal charge is needed before police can take money or assets, which is a critical move to start outlawing the practice of civil forfeiture in the state. A second bill overhauling forfeiture law remains in the House Judiciary Committee. Now, these bills were prompted by a series of stories the Greenville News did detailing $17 million taken from people in South Carolina from 2014 to 2016. Number three, the Post and Courier reports that a House-approved bill would make it a felony to make significant plans or steps toward terrorism, punishable up to 30 years in prison. Now, terrorism is a state crime, but plotting to commit terrorism is not. If it had been a state law in 2015, then York High School student Zakiera Abdel Abdin could have been charged with something more than illegal gun possession when an arrest revealed a plot to rob a gun store and attack a military base. Number four, the state newspaper reports that Santee Cooper came under fire for its plan to pay its top executives nearly $511,000 in bonuses over the next 9 months. These bonuses were to go to seven executives approved by the Santee Cooper CEO Jim Brogdon. Are meant to keep top talent at the state-owned utility during this period of tremendous uncertainty. Now, the House and Senate are debating whether to sell Santee Cooper after it racked up $4 billion in debt on the failed V.C. Summer nuclear power plant project. And just like my ability to understand anything that's going on with Brexit, we've buried the lead.
Our jokes are going international, guys.
Can we just keep it to American problems, please? So we're still, what, 670 days away from the 2020 primary?
Actually, only.
That is obviously too much.
Yeah, that's, I know. That's several years.
That's the joke. We're actually 333 times it by two.
Watch out.
No, it's been a little bit more than a month since we last did our 2020 episode. I promise you these episodes will become more frequent once we get closer towards 2020, obviously. And then once we get a session, so in our summer months, we'll be keeping up with that. And of course, once the state's press corps stops churning out such great investigative journalism, we can't help it. There's just too much to cover.
That's not on me, I can assure you.
There's too much to cover. So to bring us up to speed, we got the band back together.
Yay.
We're going to catch up on what's been going on the campaign trail with the Post and Courier's Jamie Lovegrove and the Associated Press's Meg Kinnard. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you very much. Gavin.
Good to be back.
Glad to be back.
Now, Jamie, you said you had a special announcement to make. You didn't tell me what it was, but make your announcement.
I do. Gavin, my fellow leaders, my fellow Americans, as some of you may have suspected over the past few months as I've been traversing the great state of South Carolina, under the guise of political reporting, I've also been exploring my own national ambitions.
This sounds big.
I've been soliciting donations to my grassroots dark money group, the Jobs and Money in Everyone's Pocket America Committee.
I've donated.
Jamie Pack, as one might call it. And I've been humbled by the support from many special interests, who are special after all. But I have decided, after deep conversations with my family, my pollsters, and my roommate's dog, Stevie, that I will not be running for president.
Oh my God.
In 2020.
Oh, please don't tweet this yet. Wait till the podcast drops.
I know this comes as a shock, because it seems like everyone in America is running for president in 2020. I can't make any guarantees about 2024.
Wow.
But I did just want to take myself off the board and leave it to the remaining 933
right.
candidates who are already running.
There's probably someone announcing as we speak.
Can we take a time out so I can rewrite the whole script for the show?
I just want to also make clear that the Jamie Pack will not be returning any donations. We will be using those funds to purchase beers this evening.
And barbecue.
At Seminar Brewing.
And barbecue
across the state.
But thank you for your support. I appreciate it.
Jamie, very powerful. Thank you. I didn't know that was coming.
Bold.
I mean, we had some great poll numbers. Meg, do you have any announcements? You still exploring?
I'm still exploring. I really haven't made a decision about 2020
I will
yet.
Donate
so
to
stay
the
tuned
pack.
To a future podcast.
Now, Meg does have a pack. It's for shoes.
It is absolutely for shoes.
So now that we got that big news out of the way, how much time do we have? Now, yes, there are a lot of people in this field. And Meg, we're going to start off with Senator Kamala Harris, the senator from California. A lot of big news came out today. We're taping this podcast on Thursday. She picked up 5 endorsements in South Carolina, 3 of those from lawmakers. We're going to talk about other endorsements and how they affect other candidates. So tell us what the importance of these ones are, quite a number of them for her, and what that means in a race like this with such a big field.
Sure. Senator Harris came out with the endorsements from 3 state lawmakers, all of whom are African American, one of whom has been in the legislature for a very long time, since the early 1990s, Senator Darrell Jackson. So the Harris campaign, for them, they see this as a moment to spark some momentum. Now, as we've said a million times, and we'll say a million more, not everybody's paying attention yet. Right? We still have a year until the South Carolina primary.
I would say most people are not paying attention.
Most people probably aren't. They certainly aren't paying as close of attention as we have to, but we do this for a living. But the Harris campaign is hoping that this will start some momentum for them and be a strong showing of support. Lawmakers in this state, in New Hampshire, in Iowa, in Nevada, are getting calls frequently, constantly probably, from the sprawling field, because for public officials to come out in support of a candidate, that could be a signal to supporters of that public official or to sectors of the community that, hey, look, this is somebody you should take seriously. So that's what the Harris campaign is certainly doing. There are other campaigns who have already come out with supporters among the legislature, 2 other campaigns in particular, we might talk about them. So the Harris campaign also, in addition to the 3 lawmakers, they had a county Democratic Party chairwoman. And they also had a former Democratic gubernatorial candidate, who I believe some of you guys might know, Marguerite Willis. So again, they're really hoping that that's going to help them kind of get on the board and have a showing of support in the primary to come next year.
And then, Jamie, when we talk about these endorsements, not only is it, hey, this lawmaker who I might have voted for is supporting this candidate, but there also comes that person they endorsed, their kind of network of people, too. You know, when you look at, Pat Hannigan or J.A. Moore or Senator Daryl Jackson, I mean, they have groups of people, they have connections in their own communities that they're tapping, and that's really also a big push for these guys to get these people locked down, especially this early.
Yeah, and I mean, these are sought after folks. I mean, you know, a lot of candidates have been talking to these people. I spent a long time with J.A. Moore in his office yesterday in the State House, and he won his seat last year in Goose Creek, beat Samuel Rivers. And, you know, ever since then, I mean, Julian Castro from Texas campaigned for him and endorsed him in his State House campaign, and he helped show him around last week. He'd been talking to Cory Booker. He'd been talking to a bunch of other folks. So it does show that the Kamala Harris team was able to make that closing push there. With Daryl Jackson, being a pastor, is also, you know, we can't talk enough about the role that the church plays in these primaries on both sides of the aisle. So it can certainly be overstated, the importance of endorsements.
Yeah.
But they are not nothing, and they do at least tend to give you a signal about who is building their team most aggressively in South Carolina and who is attracting very early interest. I mean, it's surprising to see so many folks coming off the board. I think we already have 5 lawmakers who have now endorsed, if you include John King for Cory Booker and Terry Alexander for Bernie Sanders. So it just shows that people are ready to get started on this.
And one thing of note specifically in Senator Harris's camp, she is a member of the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority, which is a very notable Black sorority in this country. And Representative Pat Hennigan is also a member of AKA.
Right.
And the Harris campaign has said that in addition to mobilizing and organizing in rural areas, which Representative Hennigan knows very well, she's also going to be working within the AKA community. It's been long talked about ever since Senator Harris entered the race and has been very embracing of her AKA sisters. How is that going to play? Because this is new territory in a presidential campaign. And the Harris campaign made very clear today, we do intend to try to tap into that network as much as we can. And we have someone from the inside who's going to be helping us do that.
And Jamie, just, I know we could keep going with the AKA connection too, but she just released that teacher pay raise plan, Senator Harris did. I mean, obviously she gets big applause lines for her education stances, especially in South Carolina where we're going through education reform issues right now. Is that directly to places like South Carolina? Obviously teachers are underpaid pretty much everywhere in this country, but is that something she can really just throw to these crowds and say, hey, look what I'm trying to do?
I mean, it made a big splash nationally when she announced that. It is rare to see someone proposing a real massive federal investment in teachers because that has traditionally been left at the state and local governments. But even when you watch national, you know, I was watching CNN the other day talking about this plan, and they said this could be particularly helpful for her in South Carolina. So people are aware that folks are paying attention to the issue of education in South Carolina. All 5 of these endorsers mentioned her plan to increase teacher pay at the federal level in their endorsements, so it's clearly already making an impact. And it's a really pretty significant number. I mean, what the State House is talking about is raising teacher salaries 4 to 10% at the state level. She's talking about raising South Carolina teacher salaries, the average teacher in South Carolina, by 19%. It's a very aggressive proposal. I think some of the details about exactly how it's going to be paid for still need to be worked out. She's talked about strengthening the estate tax, which is currently on folks who make or have assets of more than $11 million when they die. It goes down inheritance, and that's taxed about 40% right now. So I would imagine she would lower the threshold for that and probably raise the percentage of that. But regardless of the details, I think the fact that she decided to make such a focus on teachers so early in her campaign stood out to a lot of folks and even got praise from other candidates. I mean, Amy Klobuchar was saying that she, you know, praised that plan. So it's good to come out with bold ideas.
And we're going to talk about all the candidates who've recently come through the state too, but I just want to wrap up with Senator Harris really quick, Meg. I was talking on WNYC the other day. Little humble brag there, but listen to South Carolina Public Radio. Thank you. But what they brought up is we were talking to this one editor out in Nevada, whatever you want to say,
Nevada,
about how the fact is that they'll be voting in California early and that'll be overlapping with a lot of other states, including South Carolina. How did we see that factoring into just how important South Carolina is going to be, especially for a state like California?
The calendar is a huge consideration. As everybody here, I'm sure, knows, and listeners know too, South Carolina has the first primary in the South. That's why we're getting so much attention from all of these candidates. There are many states that come right after, a lot of other southern states, but the big behemoth is California, which is obviously Senator Harris's home state. So yes, there will be early voting occurring even before our polls open here. Obviously, those votes won't be counted yet, but there will be people already making their decisions and perhaps talking about their decisions. So while the results in the South Carolina primary can sometimes be an indicator of how other states will go, particularly other states, that certainly was the case for Senator Clinton in 2016, it is going to be kind of new territory to see what happens with a big state like California already beginning to weigh in when the polls here haven't really, you know, done their thing in South Carolina and people haven't
voted. Momentum will be big.
That's right.
Especially in a big field like that. Switching gears to New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, Jamie. You were down there in Orangeburg, her CNN town hall for Booker.
Yeah.
What was the vibe like? What have you been seeing on the campaign trail with, I'm throwing curveballs, with Booker specifically? I mean, we've been seeing him in these small towns visiting and that strategy. How's that playing for him?
Yeah, I mean, he, you know, as I've written about, before last night's town hall, he's made a very concerted effort to go beyond the big cities early in his campaign. His very first trip to South Carolina was to Winnsboro, Sumter, Denmark. Then he came back and went to Simpsonville. He went to Somerville. And, you know, I asked him about that, and he said that that is, you know, very intentional, not surprisingly, you know, to demonstrate that he, you know, is trying to be a candidate for everybody, not just folks in the vote-rich metropolitan areas. And it does allow you to differentiate yourself from the candidates who are just going to some of those big cities early. He said he came back and talked to us last night after the CNN 10 Hall in Orangeburg and made quite clear that he deliberately chose Orangeburg for that CNN town hall. It was up to him where to do it. As you may have been following, if you've watched some of these CNN town halls, CNN's been doing these for a lot of candidates. So they've been kind of picking where they want to do it. And he chose Orangeburg. He had students from SC State and Claflin University, two historically black universities, you know, and talked about the importance of historically black colleges and universities. As we've talked about ad nauseum on here, you know, 61% of the Democratic primary electorate in South Carolina is African American. So demonstrating your commitment to communities like that can go a long way.
And switching gears, and speaking of Orangeburg, Meg, we were all down there the other week for former Texas Representative Beto O'Rourke. He was making his whirlwind spin through the state. Mm-hmm. But we also saw him at the University of South Carolina in Columbia, and then we saw him in Orangeburg at South Carolina State University, as Jamie said, historically black college. What was the difference you saw in the crowd sizes and maybe the messaging we saw from Beto at both of those events?
The crowd at USC was, I would say, markedly larger. Some of the campaign folks estimated it 2,000. I think that's a bit generous. But it was a big crowd, and it was also a very white crowd, which we all noticed. That was just, it was pretty obvious. But a lot of the students that I talked to there, you know, they'd heard the buzz about Beto O'Rourke. I mean, he's been barnstorming through the early states. We were the third on his tour of the first three early states. And he hit on a lot of issues that I think millennial voters and younger voters are very interested in. And, you know, the students that I talked to had heard the buzz. They were kind of aware of who he was. But very few of the students of those younger people in the audience had really showed up intentionally because they're very interested in his campaign. I'm sure some of them were. Maybe those were just the ones I talked to. But it was kind of like a curiosity thing. If we want to check this out, we want to see what this guy's talking about. He did go to SC State in Orangeburg later that day where it was a smaller crowd, but there were some enthusiastic people. Both of these events were town hall style, so Beto O'Rourke gave his spiel, but then he kind of opened it up, open mic, to some people in the crowd, and so they got their opportunity to ask about healthcare funding, about are you going to take money from the fossil fuel industry, some of that consistent messaging that we've heard people along the trail ask every candidate. But at SC State, I mean, there were people asking critical questions specific to the African-American community. How are you, if elected president, going to do certain things, like to make sure that, you know, I have equal access to healthcare and equal...
dealing with systemic racism.
Exactly, institutional racism. Mm-hmm. And how can you make sure that I can borrow money with the same sort of freedoms that a white person could? So the questions were certainly different. He did his best to answer them. But as we've noted, this is the first state where the most of the Democratic primary electorate is African American. It's the first place for all of these candidates to test out their messaging in front of that audience. Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada don't offer the same opportunity. So a lot of the candidates, Beto O'Rourke perhaps included, are still trying to kind of feel their way through that. Clearly in Texas, you know, if he had been elected senator, he would have represented quite a few African American constituents. But South Carolina is unique in terms of the early voting states. Mm-hmm. And so it's still kind of a, you know, I'm not going to say that they're just throwing things against the wall, because I think there is a more intentional bit of messaging that's going on all fronts, but that there is some of that.
And I want to stick with you, Meg, really quick, because you and the AP had a big story about kind of his staffing situation and looking at, you know, it's a nascent campaign at this point, but they also raised $6.1 million, the most of any campaign, and within 24 hours of announcing. Obviously, you know, he ran a Senate campaign in Texas, which is its own country, we can all admit that. So it's, I mean, you would think it'd be easy to scale up maybe, but I know he has some support on the ground here in South Carolina, but it still seems like they're trying to make it at least appear like it's a grassroots campaign, even though it's maybe kind of hard to understand that it is with $6.1 million in the bank.
That's right. I mean, the O'Rourke campaign has made a commitment at this point to trying to keep as much of that touchy-feely grassroots piece to their campaign. Yeah, the vibe. And you know, that sounds great. And it does, you know, work well in some instances. But when you're scaling up to the level of a presidential campaign and you're spending all of this time in all of these early states fairly simultaneously, and this is something I asked him directly when he was in South Carolina, how is that sustainable? How are you going to do that if you don't have dedicated staff in these places? And at that point, didn't have a national campaign manager. That has changed in the last couple of days. So they are still trying to figure out what's going to work best for them while still maintaining that feeling of authenticity with that grassroots feel. I mean, his answer to me was, we've got dedicated volunteers. We've got lots of people who are very committed to helping us and to getting out there and pounding the pavement with our message. And that's not to say that's not going to work.
Sure.
Who knows? It could. But at least when you're trying to really do all of this large-scale stuff all at the same time, pretty much, it's been a little bit difficult. There have been some growing pains, and so that's what we wanted to explore.
And you don't want to lose that momentum still, even though it's early on. You don't want to you know, make any missteps. But Jamie, you can talk to that too, but I want to ask about the South Carolina GOP coming out and issuing their first kind of warning shot at Beto O'Rourke. We haven't seen them attack any other candidates coming through the state, but this is kind of their first on-the-record official statement, hey, watch out for this guy.
You know, I was with him in Rock Hill, and he did that kind of, you know, impromptu, stand on a chair, talk to a packed bakery kind of thing. And, you know, certainly the way that the Beto supporters respond to the SCGOP coming after him is to say that they're scared of him. You know, that's evidence that he has some serious threat, some serious, traction, credibility for the GOP to be concerned about. So they're perfectly happy for Republicans to be attacking him. I think any candidate in a Democratic primary is happy for Republicans to be attacking them, because it demonstrates to folks that they have caught the other side's attention. But, you know, the one other thing I would just say about him that I was struck by, particularly in Rock Hill and Charleston, was that he was the first candidate I really found, other than Bernie. I've noticed this at Bernie's events too. I talked to a lot of folks who were like fully sold on Team Beto, specifically in Rock Hill and Charleston. You know, even at USC, we saw some folks wearing Beto O'Rourke t-shirts.
Yeah.
Generally, when I go to Kamala Harris events, Cory Booker events, other big names, they say I'm still shopping around, I'm still checking everybody out. But there were a lot of folks who were like, I'm fully on the Beto train, which was surprising.
And Meg, kind of switching to Mayor Pete Buttigieg, we saw his event there in Columbia, and you were also, you saw Beto, you saw Booker, and you saw Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Buttigieg, learn it,
Buttigieg.
Love it. Not love it. I'm not endorsing here. I'm just saying learn how to say it. But what did you see in those crowds? I mean, you were able to jump from three big candidates within a day of each other. I mean, and going to Jamie's vein there. I mean, I spoke with people too, and they were like, I saw him on, I saw him on Facebook. I'm all in already. And you see the comments on our videos. I mean, it's like people.
That was a lot of the vibe that I got, particularly at the Mayor Pete event. And I'm just going to go with Mayor Pete.
Yeah,
so I'm not butchering the last name.
Safe.
But it is Buttigieg, so I've heard. But there were a lot of folks at that event that I was seeing and interacting with who were just like the ones that Jamie described and some of the others who are all in,
yeah.
who are really interested in the candidacy that Mayor Pete has put forward. Obviously, he's a millennial. He's different. He's also gay. He's married. He's got a lot of things that, you know, it puts forth a very different campaign and one that we haven't seen. And it's not just because of those things people are interested in him, but it's a whole vibe. And I think voters across the board that I've talked to and kind of asked, where are you in this whole primary thing? I mean, it's early, but you're at a candidate event, so you're interested. A lot of what I hear from people is they want to feel inspired. They want to have that moment, which for them was when they saw then-Senator Barack Obama, and when they kind of felt, this is something different, and this is a moment, and this is a place where I would like to see our country go. And so as they're out candidate shopping, they're really trying to see who's going to give them that feeling. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are still trying to figure it out, obviously, but I have run into some, and at Mayor Pete's event there were some too, who feel like they may have found that moment with him.
And I've heard that from someone I spoke with as well. But Jamie, kind of looking at his numbers, told me he's shot up in the polls too recently.
He has. I mean, we haven't had many South Carolina polls, but nationally he shot up. Iowa, he has shot up. You know, he's clearly having a moment, and he's getting asked about that, you know, now. I mean, you know, sort of what does it feel like to go from a guy, you know, who nobody really knew outside of either South Bend, Indiana, or Democratic circles, because he did run for DNC chairman back in 2016, early 2017. So, you know, there are folks who are aware of him, but he also, you know, he's a veteran, and we don't have many of those in this field either.
Yeah.
And he's able to use, you know, he's had this very effective line when folks ask him about experience of a 37-year-old presidential candidate. You know, where he says that I have more military experience than, you know, anyone since George H.W. Bush. I have more executive experience than the president. You know, that goes a long way with folks. And I think that was an early introduction to him. And he has really held his own. He's a Harvard-educated guy. He's clearly extremely smart. And he has done a surprising amount. And there are all these crazy stories coming out from his time in South Bend, too, you know, interactions that people have had with him in South Bend that I think have really impressed folks. So he's clearly on the rise.
Yeah, he seemed to have a pretty good reception in Columbia. I know they weren't expecting such a big crowd, but, you know, that's here and there. Like, you get a smaller space, you pack it out, like you're talking about what you saw with Beto, too. So it's
definitely.
But they had to expand in Rock Hill, too. So there's a lot going on. He did jump up nationally in some polls, and he did qualify for the fundraising goal to qualify for the debates is this summer.
A lot of people are
going to
qualify.
We'll jump into that towards the end. We're going to talk really quick about Bernie, and then we got a Biden watch. So,
okay.
Biden watch.
Batten down the hatches.
That's the big
one. We got some big ones going. But Bernie, Meg, you and me were both in North Charleston when Bernie made his first trip back to South Carolina after announcing his candidacy. Mm-hmm. What, 1,200 people were there?
It
was the same space we saw Senator Harrison, mm-hmm. too. So similar crowd. But a little bit different, but at the same time, it felt like a rally from 2016 when we covered him in 2016. It felt like it was 2020 January, roaring up for the 2020 primary. I mean, like, he has that built-in base in South Carolina. People know him. He has that name recognition, which is why he's so high in the polls. But there's so many people that you talk to, and they say, well, I'm also leaning towards other people in the progressive field. Is that going to chip away when there's so many other people on that Bernie-type spectrum?
There are more options now. In 2016, there weren't as many. There were a lot of people here and in other places who were looking for an alternative to Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And in that, they found Bernie Sanders. Anybody who's looking for, quote unquote, an alternative to anybody, because, I mean, the field is very wide open at this point, but the folks who may have found that themselves in that camp before have a lot more options. There is a wide spectrum of Democratic candidates who are putting themselves forth, and I include Bernie Sanders in that, even though he is technically an independent, but he does caucus with the Democrats and is clearly seeking their party's nomination. That's a point of contention among some folks that we talk to around here, because they're like, well, if he's going to seek our party's nomination, he should be a Democrat. That's a constant refrain that we've heard. He's clear in saying that that's not in his plans at this point. But you're right. Now people do know Senator Sanders' name, and so there are some folks who supported him back in 2016 who say clearly, he's still my guy, I'm going to stick with him, and I'm with him for the long haul this time. There are some difficulties that come along with that, though, because his name is well known, but not all of the people who remember him in a positive way. Let's remember, in 2016, Senator Sanders actually left South Carolina the week before the primary to campaign in the Midwest because he knew at that point he was more likely to have success in other states than he was in South Carolina. That's, you know, somewhat of a distant memory at this point, but it did rub some people the wrong way and thinking, well, he just gave up here, so why would I go back around with him this time? For his part, Senator Sanders says he has a different strategy for South Carolina this time. Intentionally, he says that he's doing more outreach to the African-American community, which, as we've discussed, is very important in the Democratic primary electorate. But that crowd that we saw there in North Charleston, which is a very African-American dominant area, was a very, very white crowd. And I asked Terry Alexander, who's a state representative who has endorsed Senator Sanders, and I asked him today, is that a problem for the campaign? Is that something that you, as an African-American member of the legislature, are going to help him with? And he said, look, there's time, there's plenty of time to make that up. The issues that Senator Sanders is focusing on are ones that will resonate with that community and with plenty of other people. So, you know, the campaign says that they have strategies to deal with that. But, you know, that is something that is going to be a very important hurdle for him to be able to get through here.
And Jimmy, you want to jump on
that? Yeah, I just wanted to add one real quick thing, which is a theme that has gone throughout all this, and I think it's important to note. Almost all of the crowds, almost everywhere except for historically black colleges, are pretty white for most
churches,
people.
Yeah.
Churches, you know, built-in black crowds. I mean, that's something. But, you know, I just think that, you know, there is something to the fact that people who go to political campaign events a year before the election at this point have seemed to be mostly white folks, even when it comes to primary day, it is going to be a majority black Democratic primary electorate.
Which is why you try and get those endorsements. I mean, Terry Alexander from the Florence area here, I mean, like, those really help you establish those ground games. Jamie, kind of sticking with Senator Sanders before we jump to Biden watch.
Is there a sound effect for that?
If there's going to be, don't worry, we're going to fix it in post.
Oh, Biden watch.
Just sticking with him, you know, one of the big things he was saying is that, you know, he was on board with all these progressive ideas before they were cool, essentially, and now everyone's making them mainstream. Does that register with these people? Hey, I was the first one, I made it cool, and now everyone else is coming along and rebranding in certain ways. Does that stick, or do people say, look at this guy, he sounds cool too?
And yeah, I mean, it could go either way, right? I mean, you know, some voters may say, well, if I have other options, other packages for the same policies, folks who are not 70, what is he, 76, 77-year-old?
One of the voters in Myrtle Beach told me, he's like, I want someone that can do two terms. And he couldn't see Bernie doing two terms.
And so if you have, you know, the same progressive policy goals from a candidate who is younger or a candidate who's more diverse, I think that, you know, could certainly be attracted to a lot of primary voters. But don't get me wrong, I mean, Bernie has some really devoted, loyal supporters here. Terry Alexander is one of them. You know, we hear from them all the time, and they are not going to be persuaded to drop him.
So a lot to watch with those established candidates. And one candidate in particular who is not a candidate yet, who everyone's kind of waiting. Everyone knows the writing's on the wall. Beto-mania obviously swept the country. Everyone's gotten through that phase. But now we're on for some, we're waiting for some big announcements with former Vice President Joe Biden. We had watch conditions, and I think we're upgrading to Category 1 warning conditions, essentially.
Biden warning.
Went from a watch to a warning. Meg, you've been covering a lot about this, the backstory, the, you know, behind-the-scenes action about staff and connections in South Carolina to Biden. What's the latest on what's happening? What can we expect, you know, within the month of April?
Vice President Biden himself has been telling people close to him that the second quarter is where we're going to see some sort of decision. The folks who know him best are telling people like me in very secretive ways that they do believe he's in, that they think that he is going to enter the race. Clearly, we don't know yet for sure 100%, but that whole situation, this, you know, tropical storm, Biden watch, warning, whatever you want to call it, has put a lot of people into a holding pattern to the point where they're starting to get, I'm hearing, a little bit frustrated that they don't really have a definitive answer. That goes back to the endorsement piece that we hit on in the very beginning. It does go to staffing. There are folks who were Biden operatives back when he sought the nomination before and have been supporters ever since who are kind of watching and waiting because people are starting to get hired here. There's all kinds of positions that are opening up with campaigns that will likely continue to be viable for quite some time. But those who are very close to Biden and support him are just kind of hanging on and waiting. So that condition continues, and it's gotten to the point where I think a lot of people are very ready for him to make that decision. I do think it is going to be coming very soon, though, and I think that, you know, it's going to very much change the landscape of what we're talking about because, yes, he's a very well-known name. His popularity remains very high. Again, that's because people know who he is and have generally formed some sort of a preconceived opinion based on his time as vice president and perhaps in the Senate before that. But in South Carolina, when he enters the race, which it does sound like he's going to, that is going to have an effect on the state of play, really, as it is.
And Jamie, kind of wrapping in with Biden, but talking about money, we're going to be coming up on that fundraising deadline for the first quarter. That's a big one. People are really pushing to raise money and get it all in before the end of March. There's speculation that Biden didn't want to jump in midway through that because he didn't want to have weak fundraising numbers. Obviously, April will be a new quarter. How does that tie in? Is that big of a factor when we look at the importance of money in a race this early on?
I mean, it's a clear signal of how strong your candidacy is early on. We've seen people already, you know, comparing candidacies based on how much money they raised in the first 24 hours, the first 48 hours. Mm-hmm. You know, Beto raised
$6.1 million
more than anybody else. Bernie raised five point something, eight. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what it was. Regardless, you know, it is something people pay attention to just to take stock of everybody. You know, I think we're going to get to this, but, you know, the debates is also what matters too. You know, I mean, you have to, so the DNC has set parameters whereby one of the ways you can get onto the debate stage is to have 65,000 unique donors mm-hmm. to demonstrate that you have some level of grassroots support. You have 65,000 different people donating to your campaign. A lot of people are going to hit that. I think the DNC might already be wondering if they should have set that number a little bit higher. I mean,
the number of emails that we all get, you know, fundraising pitches,
yeah.
Can you just give me a
people
dollar?
Are doing,
I mean,
creative
they're going
things.
Straight for
but
that.
Then you factor
people
in the polls.
John Delaney, who's came, many of you might not know, he's a Maryland congressman. He's been running for 2 years. He is doing a thing where if you donate to his campaign, he'll donate, for every $1 you donate to his campaign, he'll donate $2 to charity. Because the amount of money that his campaign has actually is not what matters. It's the number of donors who donate to their campaigns is what matter at this point. So we are in this bizarre situation. I'm pretty sure Andrew Yang has already hit the number, so he's going to be on the debate stage. The polls are going to matter as well. So there is like a poll qualification where you have to register a certain amount in 3 polls or something like that before the debate. But yeah, I mean, fundraising is always a key strength. And what I'm going to be interested in looking at in the filings, too, not to give it away, is where they're spending their money early, too, if they're spending it on any folks in South Carolina that we don't know about or any firms in South Carolina, you know, just to get a sense of where they are deploying the money that they are bringing in at this early stage.
Again, there's going to be 6 debates in 2019 and 6 more in 2020. The first 2 are going to be in June and July, so it's all kind of important. Like we're talking about weeding people out, and that's going to be a big one is money and polling. We'll see that going forward. And of course, there's always the curveballs that could happen. We were talking about the old Howard Dean scream.
Yeah.
Yar! We'll put that in post. But I mean, anything can happen, and it's early, and things are still happening, which is why we're covering this for the people that maybe aren't paying attention in and out every day to what's going on. We're trying to keep you guys updated. Thank you
so
much. We do
it so you don't have to.
For listening to us. I know we rambled for a good while, but hey, we were due for a good 2020 discussion.
Needed to get the band back together.
That's right.
You know, I want to thank the Post Encourage, Jamie Lovegrove, and the Associated Press's Meg Kennard for being with me. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to this great crowd. Wow. Woo. Thank you, Florence. Magic City.
In our final section, did you know, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. And did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is back with some more great state trivia? He is. Hey, Russ.
Here. Thank you. Glad to be here. Okay, we might get a little pushback on this one, the last one. Which of these counties is not a true county of the PD? Which was not a true county of the PD? A, Florence. B, Marlboro. C, Dillon. D, Oree.
Oh, well, the PD ends up in Oree.
Question.
So that, I mean, if you want to go by the...
Okay, what are we doing? Okay, A... Show of hands. A, Florence.
Five
mine's the PD. I don't know who is
B.
The
river. Marlboro.
Marlboro, I think it might be Marlboro.
C. Dillon.
Dillon, the river goes through Dillon. I voted for B.
D. or E.
Well, I guess the Grand Strand. Wait, you're talking about historic? No. I'm spicing his words because this is how he works. I mean, it's Grand Strand, so technically it's the Grand Strand, but I feel like you're going by the river itself, which ends down there.
Okay,
so.
The county that is not a true county of the PD
I'll go
Florence.
Ooh.
Do you see this?
I told you there'd be some pushback. Back in the day, the PD region of the state was considered the land between the PD River and the state of North Carolina. That included four counties, Marlboro, Marion, Dillon, or Reed. So, what the Pearl of the PD over in Darlington says, like
yes,
that, I don't know.
Go to Pearl's Diner.
But those counties, I think, became grouped as part of the PD region back when the tobacco region was, they became synonymous with the tobacco region of this state.
That is some great trivia, Russ.
Russ McKinney strikes again.
Thank you, Russ. Wow.
My pleasure.
Wow. Thanks again to Seminar Brewing and our dedicated listeners in Florence. The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on SCETV.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's Super Easy to Use app and SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. Subscribe to us and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at @SCLeadPod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at @SCLEDEPOD. We have swag, sticker swag that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier and the Associated Press. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced at Seminar Brewing in Florence, South Carolina, on March 28, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. Warning. Do not engage in any way with Elon Musk's Harambe rap. Come on, guys. He's already a billionaire.
Tropical Biden warning.